Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Skip Rhodes, past chair of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors and your chair for the program. Today's program is part of the Commonwealth Club series, The Ascent of Women, sponsored by Wells Fargo & Company and Ernst & Young. It is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Rosalynn Carter, former First Lady of the United States, married to former President Jimmy Carter, and author of the new book, Within Our Reach, Ending the Mental Health Crisis. Former First Lady Rosalynn Carter has worked for more than three decades to improve the quality of life for people around the world. Today, she is an advocate for mental health, early childhood immunization, human rights, and conflict resolution through her work at the Carter Center, which she and former President Jimmy Carter founded in 1982. A full partner with the President in all of the Center's activities, she created and chairs the Carter Center's Mental Health Task Force. Each year, she hosts the Rosalynn Carter Symposium on Mental Health Policy, bringing together leaders of the nation's mental health organizations to address critical issues. Outside the center, Mrs. Carter is president of the board of directors for the Rosalynn Carter Institute for Giving at Georgia Southwestern State University, which was established in her honor on the campus of her alma mater in Americus, Georgia. A mother of four, she has maintained a lifelong dedication to issues affecting women and children. Her honors and awards make up a lengthy list, so I will only mention two. She was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom, America's highest civilian honor, and in 2001, she was inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame. Please join me in a warm Commonwealth Club welcome to Rosalynn Carter, who will speak to us today on the subject of ending the mental health crisis. Mrs. Carter.
Thank you. And thank you, Skip, for that introduction. I love San Francisco, and I'm so thankful that you invited me to be here because I could come back. Thank you. And I was going to tell you a little bit about some of my experiences in San Francisco, but I think it's already been in the paper because we lived on Mare Island for 3 months when Jimmy was in the Navy and used to come into town. And somebody told me this morning that had the story about us going to the top of the Mart. Jimmy was in the Navy. We'd been married, had one baby, another on the way. We went to the top of the Mark, and they wouldn't serve us a drink because we were too young. But I have some really fun and have been in San Francisco lots of times. And before I start more with my remarks, though, I want to introduce you to Susan Golot. She's on the front row down here. She's co-author of the book with me. And she lives in San Francisco. Well, I have been working on mental health issues for a very long time, more than 40 years. It doesn't seem possible, but it does seem like I've been working on it for all of my life. I became interested in the 1960s when Jimmy first ran for governor, and I campaigned across the state. And it was a time when people in the country, people with mental illness were in big institutions, and we had a big institution in Georgia, just in a terrible place. And there had been a big expose, of our hospital in 1959, and then in 1963, the Community Mental Health Centers Act had been passed. And so when I was campaigning, people were being moved out of Central State into the community with no services available. And every day, somebody was asking me, if your husband's elected governor, what will he do for my loved one who's at Central State Hospital? One morning, I was standing at a cotton mill at 4:30 a.m., waiting for the shift change when so many people got off from work and people are coming to work, and I was passing out Jimmy Carter brochures. And I saw this woman come out. She was the first one out. She came out all by herself, and she was little, and I could tell she was so weary from working all night long, and she had lint all over her hair and on her clothes. And when she got to me, I said, I hope you're going home to get some sleep. And she said, I hope I can too. And then she started telling me about her daughter who had a mental illness. And she said, we struggle to take care of her. And so I work at night when my husband's at home with her, and he works in the daytime while I stay with her. And the picture of that woman haunted me all day long. And that night I was in Statesboro, Georgia, campaigning. I won't forget, never forget it, because I found out that Jimmy was going to be there too. This was a very disorganized campaign. Because Jimmy was in the state Senate actually running for Congress, and our leading Democratic candidate for governor dropped out and left Lester Maddox. The candidate that dropped out had a heart attack and left Lester Maddox, who was a big segregationist. He had a restaurant in Atlanta, and he would stand in the door with his pig handle. That was his kind of motto. No black person will come in my restaurant. And so Jimmy said he was going to Atlanta to see who was going to run against him. But first time in 100 years we'd had a Republican candidate, too. And if you remember, it was 64 when the 64 election, and a lot of people in our country switched, and in our state switched and became Republicans, running on Goldwater tails. And this man had been elected to the Congress, and he was going to be running for governor. So Jimmy went to Atlanta, and I was keeping the business. We had a farm supply business, and I was walking home about a half a mile from our business. I was walking home for lunch and passed Jimmy's mother's house, and she called me and said, Jimmy's on the telephone. So I went in, and he said, do you have a chair? And I said, no. And he said, well, you better get one. And he told me that he was going to run for governor. It was a big shock. And but he had been there, and nobody would take on Lester Maddox. He's very popular and actually won the election. But it was an interesting election because there were so many people running. But Jimmy lost by 20,000 votes, and I've often thought that if he had won, he would have never been president that time. But on this night he was running, and this was 1966. And so I got in line. It was a big rally in Statesburg, and I had stayed. I got in the back of the line. He didn't know I was there. And I walked down with people, and half of my life is spent in receiving lines. And you know how you'll put your hand out and talk to whoever's coming by? And before you reach, and then you'll reach for the next one before you see that person. That's what Jimmy did, and he reached for me. And then he kept talking, and finally looked, and he said, what are you doing here? This was a short campaign because the governor, it was late in the election when Jimmy got in. I was supposed to be somewhere else. And I said, I came to see what you're going to do for people with mental illnesses when you're governor of Georgia. And he said, we're going to have the best program in the country, and I'm going to put you in charge of it. Well, of course, he didn't put me in charge of it because I didn't know anything about the issue then. But when he became governor 4 years later, he established the Governor's Commission to improve services to the mentally and emotionally handicapped. And I was a member of that commission. And that was the beginning of my education about mental health issues. And then in the White House, I had a President's Commission, which he announced within a month after he was inaugurated. And we worked really hard for 4 years. We held public hearings across the country. We analyzed the problems in depth. We made important recommendations about how to improve our mental health system and develop legislation. And that's not easy in 4 years, and with the way Congress works and the way the government works. Actually, in October of 1980, we got the Mental Health Systems Act passed and financed. It was one of the most exciting days of my life when it went through Congress, and we celebrated. Unfortunately, the celebration didn't last very long because the next president, and that was October, November, Jimmy was, as he says, involuntarily retired from the White House. And the next president, is it all right if I say he was from California? He abandoned my mental health legislation. And it was one of the biggest disappointments of our life. It was not perfect, but it could have made a considerable difference. Things like the need for mental health professionals. We had such priorities for them. Well, I'll go on to talk about it, but because it was so distressing. 25 years later, when President Bush had a President's Commission, it was the next one, and that commission concluded in 2002 that mental health system in the United States is in a shamble and there is no way to fix it. We have to start over and transform the system. And when we look at the recommendations, they were almost the same thing that we recommended in 1978. It is so sad. Like filling gaps for children and for elderly citizens, correcting the shortage of trained mental health professionals, which I mentioned, providing adequate support services for those suffering from serious mental illnesses. See, what we could have done if that legislation had taken effect. Well, since I first began working in the field, I've met hundreds, even thousands of citizens, young and old, rich and poor, people from all walks of life who have shared with me their personal stories of pain and suffering and even loss of a loved one because there was no help available. And what is so sad is we know what to do and we don't do it. During the past two decades, we've learned so much about the brain and the power of individuals to recover, even from major mental illnesses. We have excellent knowledge about effective treatments and good models for delivering them. We have early intervention strategies to prevent more serious problems later in life. We're even beginning to understand how to promote resiliency in children at risk and those struggling with the most serious disorders, teaching them to be able to meet adversity and to live good lives and not let it affect them all of their life. Many people have asked me why I decided to write within our reach. Well, I've worked on these issues for so long, so many years, and we still have so far to go. Millions of people suffer. And I often think about what the great anthropologist Margaret Mead said to me. When I decided to work on mental health issues when Jimmy was governor, she came to see me. And she said, she was glad I was doing that, but she said, it's not going to be easy. And she was right. Back then I couldn't, back then was the time when no one would talk about mental illnesses, no one would admit having a family member with mental illnesses. No one wanted to be associated with the subject. I had a hard time getting people even to come to my meetings. When I had mentioned that I might work on mental illnesses in 1966, all of the advocates in Atlanta descended on me and said, "We need you." All five of them, if you can believe that. This was a time, as I said, when people just did not want to be associated. And when I would have a meeting, my five advocates would come, and maybe a few employees, government employees, because Jimmy was governor. It was so hard to get started. But and now, after, well, let me go back to what Margaret Mead said to me. If we select, and this is what I think about, and I still think about it today, and I have great appreciation for all people who work on mental health issues. If we select for our first consideration the most vulnerable among us, the emotionally disturbed child, the person institutionalized with psychosis, the street addict, then our whole culture is humanized. Well, after all my years of advocacy and the efforts of so many other people like me who have worked on this issue for so many years, I remain deeply frustrated and even angry that we fail to measure up to Margaret Mead's standards. I wrote this book because I want everybody to know what I know about mental health issues, about mental illnesses, so we can get over the stigma and get on with doing what is good and right for people with mental illnesses. This is a serious book with an important message. It's about an issue that touches every family in America. Think about your own personal situations. I'm certain that you know someone who at this very moment is struggling with depression or anxiety or other mental or emotional problem, because approximately one out of every four adults in our country is affected each year. One out of five children is experiencing mental and emotional difficulties. Mental illnesses do not discriminate. They touch every part of our society: parents, teenagers, siblings, people living in rural settings, in cities and on Indian reservations, homeless, unemployed, the clergy, even CEOs. One of my good friends who is CEO suffers from depression. It is our nation's largest hidden epidemic and a major public health issue. This is another thing I've been working on for a long time. Mental health and physical health, I don't like to separate them because they're all part of the body. They're all biological, and there should be no difference. If somebody has a mental illness today, mental illnesses can be diagnosed, they can be treated effectively, and the overwhelming majority of people can lead full and productive lives in their communities. People don't know that. I want people to know that. But physical and mental health have always been separated. For instance, the Centers for Disease Control has never taken on mental health issues as an illness. And I've been working with them for years. When David Satcher was at Centers for Disease Control before he became Surgeon General, he was really interested in mental health, and we developed a group within CDC, but it's never been able to be legal for the Centers for, I don't know what has to be done, but they just have not accepted it as an illness to do work like they do with other illnesses, like surveys in the communities to see how many people have an illness and what needs to be done about it, what can prevent it. That's never been done with mental illnesses. What a difference it could make if Centers for Disease Control would take that on as a real illness. And they're getting closer to it. Have a good working group there now, and the new head of the Centers for Disease Control is very interested in that. So that's something that I'm really, really excited about, them getting closer to that. I've been fighting stigma since my early days as an advocate, and I believe it is the principal reason we have not made more progress in the field. Why is it that we continue to discriminate against people living with mental illnesses, failing to invest in more comprehensive services and denying them access to quality care? My hope is that my book will help dispel the myths and misconceptions about these illnesses that cause so many people to keep their problems hidden and hinder all our efforts to help them. And so many people don't go for help because they don't want to be labeled as having as mentally ill. It's so distressing to me today when so much we can do for them. It's time for all of us to speak openly and candidly about mental health issues and to draw attention to the incredible progress that has been made. Today, the overwhelming majority of people living with these illnesses can recover. They can recover and lead full and productive lives, as I've said, going to school, working, raising families. When my mental health commission, ours, issued its final report, we didn't even mention recovery. Back then, nobody ever dreamed that people could recover. And I think that recovery is the single biggest advancement in the last 40 years since I began working. And a lot of the progress about that is due to efforts like Larry Fricks, Joel Slack, and Pat Deegan. These are consumers, people living with mental illnesses, and you will meet them when you read my book, meet their stories. They have led a revolution. It's really incredible what consumers are doing. When we had back in 1978, when we had our President's Commission, a woman named Judy Chamberlain wrote a book, Own Our Own, and it was about alternative means of treatment, which included the consumers, the people that were mentally ill. And so we called her to testify before our committee, because we'd never thought of recovery, as I said. But she came and worked with us then, and we had one little clause in our President's Commission report on the human rights of people with mental illnesses. But she started having meetings with other consumers, and some of my friends, Joel Slack and Larry Fricks, were two of those. Joel Slack is now my mental health task force, and Larry Fricks I've worked with forever in Georgia. And Joel started a consumer in the Department of Health in Alabama. He started a consumer services organization, and working with consumers, which now we know and have learned that we have to do in a different way. And then Larry Fricks began the one in Georgia in our state health department, and in Georgia now we have great consumer advocacy program, where we've all, well, a consumer program. And we have 500 certified peer support counsel people that counsel with people, peer support peers. And they go all across the state looking for people with mental illness. They fold them in. And consumers... It's so exciting what happens, because they can relate to the consumer, because then they have been through the same kinds of experiences. So these two departments were started in Alabama and in Georgia, and Larry now is across the country getting these consumer departments in different states. It's spreading rapidly, and he also was able to get Medicaid to pay consumers to work and counsel and treat other consumers. And he says that has made a total difference because for the whole consumer organization. Because, he said, Medicaid does not pay someone who is disabled. So it gives them respect. And we have a great consumer organization in Georgia now. Besides the peer support people, they have now begun a facility where people can come for a couple of weeks. I sent one young man there, and it changed his life. He said, I've been in and out of hospitals. I've been in about trying to get over my illness. He said, 2 weeks in this place, and my life has changed, because they have a respect for him. And as Joel Slack says, respect is the only thing it has to be. People have to be respected. What we've learned, and Tom Insel, I talked to Tom Insel at National Institute of Mental Illness, and he was very distressed because at the institute. They have always thought, he told me, that they had thought that someday they would develop this great silver bullet that would cure mental illnesses, and it has not happened, and they're not x-rays and not ways to find mental illnesses. He said we found out that medication is not all that's needed. And that's what the consumers have realized. And the consumers, what we know now is consumers have to play a role in that treatment. And they have to have some help. And one another, they have to have hope that they can get better. And with the consumers who have recovered, they see that there is hope available that they can get better. For too long, the people with mental illnesses were told that their cases were hopeless and there was no chance to lead a meaningful life. And that has been the treatment for mentally ill people in the past. And they go for help, and they're told that their meaningful life is over. Today, thank goodness, all of that is changing. Hope for a better life, strength based on self-awareness and respect, form the foundation for a new way of thinking about living with mental illness. And we're beginning to shift. It's going to take a long time, but the mental health community is realizing that, to shift from controlling mental illnesses to recovery. And when people think they can recover, it just puts a totally different aspect on their life. I believe that we are on the verge of a breakthrough in the mental health field. We recognize that recovery is now possible and that people like my friends Larry and Joel can achieve, in Joel's words, full personhood. It's interesting how they feel. Not like full normal people. And every day we're learning more about prevention and early intervention activities, which have the potential to reduce the risk and severity of mental illness, especially among children. Now the challenge we face is to make up for the decades of neglect, inattention, and discrimination those with these illnesses have endured. But unless we harness our energies and change the way we deal with mental health issues in our country, I fear the exciting advances that have been made in my lifetime will have no impact. And we will lose the chance to improve the course of lives, of millions of lives. We can't let this happen. We know in the mental health community we have to do something about it. And we can't let people continue to be stigmatized and continue to be treated. We have treated people in our country with mental illnesses like second-class citizens for far too long. To me, the way we treat these people is a moral issue. To neglect those who, through no fault of their own, are in need, runs counter to the values of decency and equality that we hold dear. Today, with our knowledge and expertise, we have a great opportunity to change things forever for all people with mental illnesses, and to move forward to a new era of understanding, care, and respect, where all can strive for and achieve a better life. Thank you very much. Thank you. And now I'm ready to answer your questions.
Good. Thanks. Our thanks to Rosalynn Carter, former First Lady of the United States and author of the new book, Within Our Reach, Ending the Mental Health Crisis, for her comments today. I'm Dr. Robert Hindren, professor and vice chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco, and your moderator for today's audience question period. Ms. Carter, we have a number of questions, so let's begin.
Okay.
There are many, many questions, actually, and I want to apologize to those of you who wrote these questions and we don't have time to get to, because I think if we went through all of them, we'd need to be here probably till late tonight, and I don't think that's in the plans, is it? No.
No. Okay,
so we'll go through some of the questions that I've tried to clump together and prioritize. But the first one was one that kind of came from several people talking to me both before and now, is the stigma that's associated with the concept or the word about a mental disorder and the different ways that it gets defined. So researchers define it in some ways, and practitioners define it in ways. When somebody asks you, what's a mental disorder, is there a way that you talk about that that can be non-stigmatizing?
Yes, I think so, because people with mental illnesses are just like everybody else. They have hopes and dreams and plans for their lives and things they want to do, and they have an illness. And I don't think there should be any distinction, as I said before, in physical and mental illness. But I think I think what I have been told and what research has shown is that the best way to overcome stigma is to realize that that neighbor who lives next door that you meet every once in a while, talk to maybe across the yard, has bipolar disorder. Well, or maybe a mother caring for her children, and you know she's a good mother, and it puts a totally new face on a person with mental illness. And so I think that's what we need to do, let people know that mental illness is just an illness like anything else, and people with mental illness have the same hopes and dreams as everybody else. Stigma is the greatest barrier to treatment and to people who are mentally ill. It humiliates them, embarrasses them. It takes away funding. It curtails funding for programs. It's so hard to get programs, funding for mental health programs. And it hurts. It just hurts so much. I had one woman who said that she went for treatment and she came home and she went back to work. And when people saw her in the hall, they would turn and go another way because they didn't know. She said, probably it's because they just didn't know what to say to me. But I think this, actually how to talk about somebody with mental illness, I think to say my friend who lives next door to me and has children and takes care of them, or it's my friend who is the CEO of a business. I have one, as I said, a friend who's the CEO of a business. He suffers from depression, but you see him going to work every day. He's mentally ill. So I think maybe we can, if you have people that you know that are mentally ill and who are functioning, and you can point to somebody and say, he has some mental illness. And as I said, I think we all ought to speak up about it, because the more people that admit they have mental illnesses and talk about it just like it's any other subject, I think would help. I think that is a good way to help.
A number of questions kind of, in a certain way, addressed your motivation for wanting to do this. Some, what got you into it in the beginning, but one that particularly attracted me was suggesting that at this point in your career, you could do a number of things, but you continue to stay passionate about this cause. And I'd add just one more thing to that, that the thing in your book that moved me the most deeply was your comment that said, ultimately, the way we treat people with mental illnesses in our society is a moral issue. So I wonder if in there you could respond about what has kept you so passionate about this issue.
Well, I've worked on it for a long time, and I want good things to happen. And we know so much. And people can live, you know, good lives, just like anybody with any other kind of illness. But the thing I think that, well, that's the thing that just wants me to keep on and on and on, because I have seen so many people recover when they never dreamed they would. And in my state, with the peer support program, I just every day see people who are now productive citizens in the community. And I want everybody who has a mental illness to be able to have that kind of help. And so I've worked very hard for it for a very long time. I was so thrilled when Parity passed, and that's a good step forward, because I think that have always thought that if insurance covered mental illnesses, it would be all right to have them because it legitimizes them. Mm-hmm. And so I think parity is going to help, except parity is limited. It doesn't help everybody. It doesn't help people with individual insurance plans. It doesn't help small businesses with few employees and so forth. According to the Secretary of Health and Human Services, whose father was governor when Jimmy was governor, that I've known for a long time, I forgot my train of thought.
Let me just go ahead and keep going on that thought, though, for a second, and it relates to recovery, and I'd like to...
Excuse me, I'm going to find out my answer.
Good.
Okay. That's supposed to happen by 2014, when everybody's covered. So that's what she told me.
Thank you. So let me read a comment from someone in the audience that I think captures something about recovery, and then I'd like to add a question about it. The comment says, my son was diagnosed bipolar in 1966. He fought the illness at first. Eventually, he realized that he was ill and that he needed meds to be well. Today, at 43, he is a lovely man who is more normal than those who think they are normal. He taught me what unconditional love is all about. Thank you for all of your work on behalf of the mentally ill. I'd like to ask you to clarify a little about what recovery means, because I worry that at times people think recovery means your mental illness goes totally away and it as though it never happened in your life, like a cure. Rather, I think you and this person are referring to something more than that. Could you talk about what recovery means in your way of understanding it?
Well, first let me say that remarks like that make me want to do more, too.
Yeah.
Because those kinds of things really make me feel that I have an obligation to try to do all I can to help them. Recovery means being able to live with an illness, being able to function and live with an illness, but people who recover probably... might always have to take medication, just like somebody with diabetes or high blood pressure. And they might they might feel another episode coming on, but they know where to go and where to get help. And so that, but recovery means that they've got the illness and the hopelessness behind them and that they're ready to face the future with confidence that they can have a good life. Mm-hmm.
I'll read a similar, another comment then that'll keep you going on feeling good, which says, I suffer from bipolar disorder and depression, but I am currently healthy and functional. Nevertheless, due to my history and gap in employment resulting from time spent in treatment, securing insurance affordable and employment has been proven difficult. What resolution, if any, do you envision to enable people like me to enjoy the same rights, privileges, and opportunities routinely granted to those not stigmatized by mental illness? And he ends, or she, by thank you, Madam First Lady.
Mm-hmm. There are probably a lot of people who are well and functioning who have had experiences like that in the past. And another thing that we've learned about people with mental illnesses who have major mental illnesses, housing is important, business is important, and I know now, for instance, that I went to Washington and met with Sebelius at Health and Human Services, and with Hilda Lopez at Labor, who was in Jimmy's intern in Jimmy's office when he was president. But they told me that people with PTSD are coming home, and which has given mental health a boost because anything that is done for PTSD helps. The whole mental health community focuses attention on it. And labor is working with employers so that they will know how to accommodate people with PTSD and veterans coming back. And they're also working with the workforce to explain what the post-traumatic stress disorder is, and for them so that they can recognize if they have the disorder and go for help, because they can be helped. And so I think that I think that most employers would be willing to accommodate illnesses. What is so sad is that people don't go for help. For instance, depression only accounts for 400 million sick days a year. And if somebody has suffered from depression and has recovered and goes to work, I think that employer would be willing to have that person have a day or two off if they got in trouble and needed some help. But at least most people who have trouble like that know where to go for help. Because sometimes just talking with someone who understands the situation, I don't know that a lot of people have that, because so many people try to keep it hidden. All of it is lack of service, lack of proper services. If we had good mental health programs and gave people the treatments and the care that they needed, we could have, look how many more productive people we could have in the workforce. Instead, we spend money. We spend $120 billion a year on health care for people with mental illness. That doesn't include supportive housing, supportive employment, and so on. $120 billion a year. Look what we could do with that money instead of these silos and different departments that have the same programs. And it's just so frustrating to me.
I'm going to continue on that line and get a little more controversial, but let me first say that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest is former First Lady Rosalynn Carter, who is discussing mental health treatment in America. So here's a little more controversial one. It says, conservative politics does not strongly support funding for mental health services. How do we sway their opinion?
I wish I knew. I wish I knew. We had the same problem with employers many years ago when I started. There was no way to tell employers that insurance for people with mental illness would not break the bank. And that's one reason you can't get services for them, because people think it's just money wasted because they can't get better. If we could ever convince people that those with mental illnesses can recover and lead productive lives, look at the difference. I don't know. We had maybe six or seven companies that were when this was many years ago, who were covering mental health issues, and we tried to convince employers, we tried to convince the mental health government agencies, but we didn't have the statistics. It took us, look how long it took us, all this time to get parity. But now we have all kinds of statistics that can prove that if you treat people with mental illness and they know where to go for help, that they can, they don't get as much insurance for health problems that they would get if they're getting mental health coverage. Because people with mental illness that sometimes don't know they have mental illness, and they don't feel good, they're depressed, don't know they have depression, but even if they do know, they don't want to access the services. But in these companies in the beginning, when it would take a while sometimes for a person to access the insurance that go, you know, the help, because they didn't want to be labeled mental illness. But when one person would go for help and was covered by insurance, and then another one would go, and then pretty soon it just became the thing to do in those companies. I watched it in Columbus, Georgia, And there's a man there who started insuring his employees before I even started working in mental health issues. And he had a lot of influence on others. And we have the statistics to prove. And another proof of that fact is the government employees that all have are covered for mental health issues on a par with other illnesses. And the cost of that was less than 1% above what they had been doing it, even in the early years. And in the later years, it's going to be less because people who are depressed and don't feel good go to the primary care doctor. And if they're treated, they know what's wrong, they get help. And so the insurance on primary care comes down. And if we could get people to know, if we could convince conservatives, people who don't want to fund mental health programs, that overall we would have so many more productive citizens in the community and spend so much less on treatment for them. It's hard to convince people, and also
we need good research and good outcomes.
That's right. So I don't know. I just, as I said, wrote my book because I want people to know the situations and how because we don't do what we know how to do, millions of people suffer, and that's not right.
I'm going to change the focus just a little bit into an area that you know I'm passionate about, which mm-hmm. is children and adolescents mm-hmm. and the Unclaimed Children Conference that you hosted at the Carter Center was a wonderful conference. We're working hard in San Francisco to develop a more integrated system of care that brings together education and juvenile justice and primary care and a number of things that you mentioned in your book mm-hmm. and in this monograph and others. But one of the questions from the audience says, you've said that 1 in 5 children develops mental illness, yet only 20% of those, it says here, seek help, but I think your book said get help. But it may be the same. But what can be done about this is the question. How can we provide better early intervention for our children?
Well, what we've learned through research is that mental illnesses are developmental illnesses. For so long, nobody in the mental health community thought that children had lived long enough to have a mental illness. That's totally wrong. It is a developmental illness, and the earlier you catch it and treat it, then it can mitigate the disease. It can keep it from getting worse, and sometimes keeping more episodes from developing. And so what we need in our country is good child care. It distresses me so much that we know what to do, and we don't do it. The same with mental illness. And we don't do anything for them until they get in trouble. And then we spend millions of dollars that could have prevented that. So I've worked on children's issues, and we had a Democratic governor, and I worked with him on children 3 to 6. And I wanted to work on 1 to 3, which I think that's the most important, to get them off a good start. And he was defeated by a Republican 2 years ago. He's running again now, 4 years ago, 8 years ago, because his Republican's been there for 2 terms. He's running again this time, and if he wins, we're going to have a great programs for children in my state. but we need to focus on children and realize how much they can be helped. And now there are all kinds of programs for the Institute of Medicine, for instance, has on its website. Programs for children, little children in nursery school, starting with nursery school, who are active and maybe overactive and so forth. Just little things that they can do that can prevent that from going on to until they get in bad situations. But there's so much we can do for little children. We ought to have parenting classes in schools so that and teach new mothers, not just teenage mothers, but all new mothers, to take their babies to have them to a professional mental health person if they see any deviation in the milestones, for instance, when they walk and when they crawl, and watch the baby in the early stages and see how it bonds with its parents, with the mother, and how it relates to peers, you know, other children in the classrooms and so forth. So much can be prevented if we just take the steps. And sometimes I had a question today at an earlier event, and this program was about we have funding for older Americans, but we don't do anything for young children. So what should we do about that? Well, I'm glad we have funding for older people. We need it for younger people too. But older people have a constituency. They have, like, AARP and other organizations that really work to try to get things for them. We don't have that with children. We have so many people like Jane Nitzer, a wonderful person who wrote the book about unclaimed children, who died, unfortunately died last year. But the wonderful people working in the field, you, Bill Bidsley, who's one of my good close friends at Judge Baker Center. And he's working with Family Talk, is Bill Bidsley's programs. And it is about children with parents who have suffering from depression. And he has tools now that can cure the parent and prevent the child from developing depression. It's amazing what we know. John Wise at Judge Baker, too, is putting it, this is another interesting thing. It takes 17 years from the time something is developed in the laboratory and research before it gets down to the level that helps people. If we find something that works for children, they're going to be grown and in trouble if we don't do anything about their problems before the research ever gets down to the level where it helps them. And so John Watts has put experts on what is new in research in the clinics to train the clinicians in what he knows and what the new research is. And it's just doing wonders. We just have a really mixed up government system.
As we continue to develop our integrative, collaborative children's development center here with UCSF and other community agencies, mm-hmm. I hope that we can call on you to help endorse that effort, because we're modeling much of it after the Carter Center.
I'll be happy to. It's one of my major interests is giving children a good start in life.
That's great. So I'm going to shift again and move into another area that the audience expressed some interest in, and I'll leave it to you to decide how far you want to go with this. But the comment says, you and President Carter celebrated your 64th anniversary in July. I don't know if that's accurate, but I assume that it is. What's been the secret of your success?
Well, I think that each partner has to give the other one some space. And I think it's space for this stuff I'll make. Because, and you know what was probably the hardest time for us in our marriage? Well, we tried to write a book together. That was a disaster. But the other time was when we came home from the White House, the first time we'd ever both been at home together all day, every day. And that was not easy. And we finally put his office, he had an office in the back of the house, and I finally took a bedroom and made me an office, because we didn't have any children, and made me an office in the other end of the house. And it solved a lot of the problems. Except I was also, at the same time we came home to the White House, I was writing my book about my memoirs, I guess you'd call it. And he gets up at 5 o'clock in the morning. Actually, I get up at 5, but I don't like to. I'm a night person. He's a morning person. That's the difference. I get up because I've been doing it so long that I've kind of gotten a habit. I still don't like it. But back then, I was getting up about 7 o'clock. So he'd get up at 5 o'clock, and I would get up at 7, and we'd eat breakfast. And then I would go in my office, and I'd get in my office about 9, I guess. And I'd start writing on my back. And when I'm writing, I have to get really absorbed in what I'm doing and put myself in the situation. And I have to be by myself. Well, in those early days, he would, about the time I really got involved, he would come in and say, "Want a cup of coffee?" Last thing I wanted was a cup of coffee. I wanted to be by myself. And so it took a little while. But I finally, he said, "I'm going to help you." Because I was having so many interruptions. My mother was coming in to see me, and I loved that. My son was in town, went in town. He was coming in. I was taking care of everything. He was in his room writing. So I was really frustrated and finally told him that he couldn't come in my office anymore at 9 o'clock. But one day he came in and said, "I'm going to help you." He brought me a sign that said, 9 to 12 working hours, do not disturb. And after that, I was always glad to see my mother in the afternoon, then I can come back and work. But if I had to get that started. And my son, and they knew they didn't disturb me because they knew that I was working. And but I think it's the space. You have to have some space, some time of your own. And we've worked that out pretty well now.
That's a good answer. That's a As long as we're on a roll on controversial questions, let me ask you, someone wrote this. It's not my question, but it was one that a number of people wondered. What do you think of Michelle Obama and, of course, President Obama? Have you met with them? Do you advise them on mental health issues or other things at this point?
Well, I went to see Michelle Obama before the inauguration, after they were elected, but before inauguration. And she told me she was going to work on post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. And then I didn't hear anything else about it. And so when I went on my book tour back in May, I had lunch with her again. And I had made a speech earlier with some mental health people there, and they all told me that this was when I was on the book tour. They all told me that they thought that she was so absorbed with obesity and trying to do something about obesity and something that they thought that she had kind of given up on that. So she had invited me to lunch, so I went to lunch. And she was talking about what she was doing, and I was on my book tour, and I told her that I was working on making speeches about my book, and that she had told me she was going to work on PTSD, and I hadn't heard anything from it since. And her assistant was there, who used to be her boss when she worked in a hospital. And she said, "Oh, we are starting it. Just a great program." She said, "We have to work on PTSD." And she told me about a woman that she had met a couple of weeks before that. And the woman said, told her that her husband was in Iraq, and she had a little boy 7 years old, and that every day he came home from school and said, "Somebody asked me again how long it was going to be before my daddy got killed." And she said, "It just tore me up." And so we've got to do something about the families and something about the fathers and mothers who come home sick. And so we're starting. And sure enough, a few weeks after that, they announced a program working on PTSD. So I was really pleased about that. And I think she's doing a lot of good things. And President Obama, I've been a little bit disappointed sometimes with some of the decisions he's made. But overall, I think he's doing. You know, when Jimmy was president, and inflation was so high because there was all these embargoes, and it was happening all over the world. Well, I think what's happening to him now is the same thing. He's trying to do what's right, but it's not popular to do what's right. And he's getting a lot of grief about it. And I sympathize with both of them because... but, you know, what I learned in the time Jimmy was in office, at first the criticisms just tore me up. And I learned that local positions are worse. Because when Jimmy was state senator, I knew everybody that criticized him, and it hurt. When you get to the state level or the federal level, you expect it. Of course, we didn't expect as much as we got, but as long what I learned was, as long as you think, and this is what I had to count on, as long as you think you're doing what is good and right and the best for the country, or whoever you're serving, the state, then you're going to get criticized no matter what you do, so go ahead and do what you think is good and right. If you feel like you're doing what's good and right, you just let the criticisms roll off. I never got totally where I could let them roll off, but most of the time, you just take them with a grain of salt. And I hope that she will learn that, understand that.
Thanks. As we're kind of nearing the end of our time, I want to be sure that we've hit on all the important points that I know are important to you. And in reading your book and in being familiar with your work and in talking to your advisors, things that I think are major themes are stigma, recovery, parity, PTSD, prevention, children's issues, which I'm passionate about, early intervention, and research. But the one that we haven't really spent any time, or at least too much time, talking about has to do with the penal system. And one of the questions came and said, what is your view of the criminalization of mental illness, the fact that 20 to 30% of all jail or prison inmates are undiagnosed and untreated with mental illness? And I would say that the figures are far higher than that in juvenile justice facilities. Do you have thoughts about how we could better integrate mental health treatment or identification of mental disorders or... Mm-hmm. I think even mental disorders are highly stigmatized in the penal system and the justice system. Do you have thoughts about how we can intervene there?
It's a tragedy. We used to institutionalize people when we didn't know better, keep them sedated. The prisoners in jails, now we just send them to the prisons. And prisons and jails are the largest mental institutions in the country. The Los Angeles County Jail is the largest mental institution in the United States. Rikers Island is second. And it's a tragedy because prison is the last place a mental ill person should be. But it's so frustrating that you can get money. You can't get money for mental health. You can get all the money you want for prisons and jails. And it's not right. But there's some good things going on in the country, and I've written about them in my book. In Albany, Georgia, which is 30 miles from Plains, there's a mental health court. And Judge Goscott, he said he was getting, I visited it, it was a great experience. He said that he was just getting people in and out, same people, mental illness, but go to jail and have to come before the judge. So he decided to establish a mental health court. And there are others across the country. Some are good and some are really good and some are not as good as others. But it's a good step in the right direction. I went to his court, and when I first got there, he said, now, and it was in a small room. It was a courtroom, but it was not like these big, of course, I've never been in courthouses much, but not like these big, empty, Seville-looking courtrooms. He said, now, I'm not going to be as, I'm going to be a little more casual than I usually am, but it's not the way I feel to be, I can't be too casual. Well, they brought people in one at a time, and they had a social worker there and a couple of nurses, I think. Anyway, they had some people there, and And what I learned was that the prison has, they have a doctor, a nurse, a mental health professional, who can, who looks at every prisoner that comes in, and if they determine that they're mentally ill, they take them to, send them to his mental health court. Well, the first woman that came in that, that day, he said, "Ma, Christine, you're looking so good, and I've been hearing you're just getting along great." And I thought, well, that's casual enough for me. And he said, and the social worker's telling me that you have your children back home now. And she said, yes, and I spent some time caring for my mother, and she's at home. I mean, it was just wonderful. And he said, well, if you keep this up, then I'm going to release you. They go to mental health court for a year, and they go in regularly. And then this young boy came in, 16 years old. He told me before he came in that he was not eligible because he had, his crime was with a gun, and that was not eligible. But he said he was at school, and he had a mental illness, and people bullied him all the time. And one day he got mad with this one person that was upsetting him so much, and he went home and got a gun and came back, but he didn't fire, the gun fired, but somebody had, had seen it earlier and was arrested, you know, was taking it away from him. But it did go off, so he's not eligible. He said, I couldn't put that young man in prison. He would be worse when he came out than he was when he went in. You know, my heart just went out to him. He was so wonderful. And so this, he said, and he's not eligible, but he had a social worker that was checking on him, and he was doing really well. And they had, and they had found a mental health they'd found treatment for him. And I don't know. So the mental health courts across the country. And also there's a CIT, Crisis Intervention Team program. It's a team. And it began in Memphis, Tennessee. Sam Cochran was the chief of police, and there was a terrible incident when the policeman shot a mentally ill person 6 or 7 times. And and the whole community, there was an uproar. And so he decided that it would be good to train some of the law enforcement people on how to recognize mental illnesses, and actually got NAMI to come in and teach them. And so now they have a CIT program in that in his community, starting them all across the country. And about 2 weeks ago, we had Sam Cochran come down to America's Georgia, my county seat, and we're beginning a CIT program in Georgia. We're already one in Georgia, and we're beginning one in our surrounding area. But and then I wanted to know somebody who had been helped. So I had one young man that I had been talking to who was having problems, and he had had a bad episode, and had threatened to. Well, he had a. He just was having a hard time. He was going through the house, and his grandmother lived with his grandmother, and she called the 911, and he told her that if somebody came, he got his grandfather's machete and he was going to chop the head off. Well, anyway, it was a disaster, and so the man from CIT went out, a policeman, and got on a microphone outside and asked him to come. He said he looked out the window, and there were all these policemen behind the bushes with guns. And his grandmother had gone out, but he got behind the... finally, the telephone rang. He finally answered. He said it rang and rang and rang, but it finally answered. And this man said, everybody has bad days or something like that. He says, how are you getting along? He said he started talking to him so calmly and finally got him to go to the door. He talked to him, and he told him that he would get everybody to put their guns down, and then they helped get him, the team, which was community people working with them, got him into treatment, and now he's really having a fulfilling life. And so the things like that that are happening across the country, I'm looking forward to the day when we take care of young people earlier, so that particularly juvenile. I've worked with the juvenile justice team at home, and it's so sad to see those young children, 2 committed suicide in our the juvenile justice system just before our Republican governor was elected. And I haven't worked with him since because I haven't been very cooperative, but we were beginning really to work on that too. So
I think we truly could go on until this evening. I think that you've got lots of energy, and so does the audience. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, we're going to need to stop. So I'd like to offer our thanks to Rosalynn Carter, former First Lady of the United States and author of the new book, Within Our Reach, Ending the Mental Health Crisis. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. Today's program has been part of the club series, The Ascent of Women, sponsored by Wells Fargo & Company and Ernst & Young. I'm Dr. Robert Hendren, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.